Good morning. I'm Dr. Gay Carlson, president of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, with number 19 of my Screenside Chats for our ACAP members. As some of you know, Screenside Chats are meant to share timely clinical practice and other information from experts on key topics during the COVID-19 pandemic that continues to plague us. Reminiscent of President Roosevelt's fireside chats during the Great Depression and World War II, I'm hoping they'll be informative and comfortable and fill a niche not otherwise filled by materials that we have available. I wanted to talk today about child and adolescent mental health care delivery. It is challenging in the best of times, but with COVID, additional layers of complexity have clearly been added. Telepsychiatry has been a help, but you still need somebody with training and skill at one end of the camera. So, our models of care need some rethinking. I've asked Dr. Richard Martini to help us with some of the considerations with which he is familiar. He has personal expertise by virtue of his previous role as Chief of the Division of Psychiatry and Behavioral Health in the Department of Pediatrics at the University of Utah and Chair of the Department of Behavioral Health at Primary Children's Hospital. He stepped back from his administrative role, but he remains professor at that site. He's also president of the American Association of Directors of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, known by its acronym of ADCAP. And ADCAP brings together our Division of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry leaders, who are responsible not only for providing child mental health care delivery at their various sites, but also responsible for training the next generation of child and adolescent psychiatrists. So thank you for being with us today, Richard.
It's a pleasure.
So tell me how you think we might improve the range of child and adolescent psychiatry services that are not just, and I mean, it's enough that if we could do a good job with inpatient day treatment, intensive outpatient, and short-term therapies, but are there other things we could be doing?
Well, you know, I think there's a number of things I think we can do to improve access, I think, to child and adolescent psychiatric services. And this is, I think, becoming particularly relevant in communities where there's a shortage of inpatient units. We really need to begin to triage clinical cases before the patient gets into the emergency room and before they're in a situation where it's a crisis. Come up with some criteria for inpatient admission and as well as some criteria for referral to intensive services. I think another thing that we can do to improve access is to look at insurance companies and to make sure that they actually have an adequate system in which they cover a wide variety of programs. I think, for example, there are some insurance companies that don't cover day treatment, that don't cover it for an extensive period of time. And I think kind of ensuring that we have that kind of coverage, I think, is important. It's also, I think, one of the things that's been going on among directors is that they've been flexible and have been developing some new programming to make access a little bit easier, particularly in times of crisis. There are open access programs, for example, in outpatient clinics now. I know at Cohen Children's Hospital in Long Island, they do this, where they reserve slots in their outpatient program for kids that have been seen in the emergency room in crisis, maybe 5 or 7 slots a week. There are programs that are developing acute care services. They're developing acute care services for families in crisis, psychoeducational programming, short-term psychotherapy, I think, that has been made available, I think, for kids and families in these situations. And then, of course, there's also been the development of mobile crisis service, mobile services that come into the home. Here in Utah, at the University of Utah, they've developed a Safe U program. They actually have an app that's connected to it. And with that, people can actually come into the home to assess kids, make some determination about the urgency and what services they need, and triage those cases. It's been, I think, a really valuable service. And I think within programs, there is a fair amount of creativity, I think, going on right now to try to meet what is an increasing demand.
So I think those sound like really important what shall I say? Well, you said triage. I think that's a good word for it. One of the things that I have trouble with, though, is there's a shortage of knowing what to do with them after you've triaged them. So, you know, the person comes in and you've got your mobile team and they decide, yeah, no, you're probably don't have to be in an inpatient unit someplace. You need to be someplace where they can do something. And then you hit the wall because you go to that place and that place, you know, that doesn't have the breadth of services you need. I mean, we need more people doing stuff. What do you see the solution to that be?
Well, you know, I think that it's a great point, Gay. I think one of the things that child and adolescent psychiatrists really need to begin to do is to advocate to broaden the range of people that are involved in mental health care and to work collaboratively with them in that process. So what does that mean? I think that there are, for example, advanced practice providers, APRNs, that I think can be incorporated into practices. And we can work with them in a collaborative way. Then not only can we work with them, but I think it's also possible to develop relationships with other kind of mental health professionals. So actually, we take a team approach and develop kind of a broader range of community-based services. And with that, I think we need to participate in the training and education of some of these people, particularly APRNs, as they look to develop standards of practice and even accreditation. I think we need to look beyond kind of our own practice for referrals. I think that is particularly true of primary care practice. There's been a lot of effort, I think, around collaborative care. It's been a big issue nationally. I think that there are probably, I don't know, maybe as many as 30 different collaborative care programs across the country with primary care practices. Some of them are very innovative. Some of them have made a really significant difference in the delivery of care. I think the idea behind it is that there's a certain level of severity that can be managed in primary care practices, that you can have patients who have ADHD, depression, for example, being treated in primary care. And if you develop a systematic approach, you can actually not only educate these primary care practitioners on what they can do, but you can also set up a referral system where patients come to you with a certain level of severity and you can refer them back to that primary care practice. So you don't necessarily hit a wall, that there is this ongoing kind of movement of patients in and out of your system. I think sometimes we as child and adolescent psychiatrists, I think we hang on to patients. I know that when we've looked at our practices, we keep patients either a short period of time, right, where they are seen, the family's comfortable with the recommendations, comfortable with the medication recs, and they go. Or we keep them for a very long time. And it's almost like we guide them through every sort of developmental milestone with their psychiatric problem. I think developing kind of more of a system where patients move in and out of our systems, in and out of our programs, I think will improve access. This is also, I think the system is also beginning to happen around tertiary care. So there are a number of consultation liaison services that are developing liaison programs with specialty pediatricians and are working in their clinics and are moving those patients in and out of those clinics and educating those practitioners on how to do some mental health care.
You and I share something in common. We're both retired directors. And so when I first started the division at Stony Brook, one of the things that I wanted our patients told when they first came in was that we would do a good job with their evaluation and get things sort of organized and stable, and then we would refer them back to whoever referred them. And, you know, it was always kind of wrenching when you came to that point because, yeah, you developed a relationship and so forth and so on. And I have to say, you also need, frankly, you can't have your practice be 100% cliffhangers. You need to have some calmness just for your own mental health. But for the most part, if people know that they have access to come back when they need you, I think it's perhaps easier for them to accept the return to the community recommendation that you make when the situation is stable. I think the other thing that I'm sort of surprised to hear you say is that we need a multidisciplinary approach. I thought multidisciplinary approaches was who we were in child psychiatry. I thought that what we were was a group of people who recognized the importance of having people in other disciplines like nurses and social workers and psychologists and speech pathologists and teachers and, you know, all of the people that are extensions of us. And so I'm wondering, how has that changed with our current system of care, that people are reinventing it, or is it being used in a different way?
You know, I think that perhaps perhaps the best example of this, I think, is our relationship with APRNs, advanced practice nurses. They are becoming increasingly involved in child and adolescent psychiatry. And I think we have not, I don't think we've come up with a consensus on how best to approach the issue of their practice, their training, the possibility of their certification. Here in Utah, they operate very independently. And I think that rather than simply saying that, you know, we can do this better, I think it would be a better idea for child and adolescent psychiatry to become directly involved, for example, in the training of APRNs in child and adolescent psychiatry. And if they are going to develop certification and accreditation processes, that we be involved in that. And that we support the development of that specialty in ways that are consistent with what we believe is good child and adolescent psychiatry, and in a way that's collaborative so that we can also move patients back and forth and communicate. I think that one of the concerns, and we've talked a bit about this among the directors, is that increasingly APRNs are operating independently. And we need to, I think that's probably the best example of a need to change our approach and to be a bit more open in the way that we look at those colleagues.
I think you're right. I think we have a mixed, we have a mixed feeling about it. On one hand, there's a concern about scope of practice. On the other hand, we have a shortage of mental health practitioners. And I think the question is if we could manage that triage that you talked about to figure out where different expertises are, that would be great. But unfortunately, we're not the boss. We're not the people that can go out and say, okay, United States, this is how we want to organize the mental health system. It's too bad, because I think you need a coherent approach. I'm not sure you get a lot, you know, everybody would agree with each other. But I do think that it's incumbent on us to make sure that our colleagues have good training so that when they do refer cases to us, they're not complete train wrecks. And I think it's appropriate for us to be sure that we've got colleagues that we can refer back to so that we know that the patients are going to get good care. One of the things that you alluded to with the emergency room bottleneck is brings up the question of boarding. That's been something that we've been wrestling with on an APA committee that I'm on, where we're trying to figure out numbers of inpatient beds. And the fact is, kids are getting stuck in emergency rooms because there's no place for them to go. And a lot of those kids are kids with developmental disabilities. They're children with significant behavior problems. Do you see a way of managing that? Is that those are really difficult cases? I don't know that APRNs are going to be the solution to those cases. Do you have any thoughts about them?
I think the boarding situation is a major challenge, I think, for child and adolescent psychiatrists and child and adolescent psychiatry programs. I think it ties into a lot of what we talked about around access. There are programs that are they're developing new ways of looking at the boarding problem. There was actually an article that came out in Hospital Pediatrics in 2017 that talked about the use of sort of therapeutic interventions while patients are being boarded, either in the emergency room or on the medical floor, that they advocated for the development of sort of psychotherapeutic and psychopharmacologic interventions that sort of began immediately when the patients were admitted. The idea behind it is that it kind of continues that sense of urgency as opposed to having them simply sit there. Mm-hmm. And I think that there was some evidence in this paper that not only did they get better, but there were a fair number of kids that were boarded that were able to go home.
Right.
And that their length of stay, their subsequent length of stay on psychiatric inpatient units was less. The other thing that has happened, I think, in a number, particularly in children's hospitals, is that they've created kind of emergency suites for psychiatric patients that they utilize, I think, on a regular basis whenever there are questions about admission, but also when there are concerns about the availability of beds. So, for example, Nationwide Children's Hospital created a unit, a youth crisis stabilization unit in their hospital. They hold these kids for 24 to 72 hours. They provide services for them. And they then, after that period of time, either determine that they do or do not need inpatient hospitalization just based on severity, mm-hmm. or they refer them to other programs, including day treatment. And what they found was that 95% of the kids that they put into this unit went home mm-hmm. After they were treated. So I think that while boarding is a problem, and it is tied into access and all the access issues that we've talked about, there are some programs that are developing some unique interventions and some unique approaches that I think are really beneficial.
We have that in our emergency room. They're called observation beds. They're not observation beds. They're treating the kid, the people there, not just kids, but also adults. But again, I thought there was often a bottleneck there for the children that weren't stable enough to go home, and there still wasn't a bed someplace for them. That there's still something of a bottleneck if you can't turn the thing over in 72 hours. In fact, I have to say, one of the things that has been an issue has been that there are many things that get set up that have been a solution, but then you can't get the person to step down to the next level of care because there's a shortage of that level of care. So there's a bottleneck in where you are. And so then, you know, you end up with this whole unit bottleneck.
Right. Yeah. And I think, you know, the other, and I think sometimes, you know, these solutions obviously aren't going to eliminate these kind of challenges and aren't going to eliminate the shortage of psychiatric beds. And I think we do need some determination about how many psychiatric beds are going to be adequate within a community. But I think that people are beginning to look at these situations and try to come up with solutions that are clinically appropriate. I mean, I think one of the other, I mentioned sort of these short-term psychotherapy programs that develop. Some divisions and departments are also sort of triaging cases as they come into the emergency department for the presence, for example, of family-based problems, as opposed to problems that are related to individual psychopathology, and are creating urgent family therapy programs on an outpatient basis that they then manage. And so they identify these cases coming in, they triage them as basically something dealing with family dynamics, and they don't even check into the emergency room. They're referred, they're triaged out at the time that they arrive. I think that these are the things that we're going to need to do. I don't know, Gay, that we're ever going to totally eliminate these kind of bottlenecks until we address issues around the availability of urgent and emergent services. But I think people are working at it anyway, and I'm encouraged that they're finding some solutions that actually make a difference.
How do you see, you mentioned collaborative care earlier in our conversation. If you ruled the world, how would you like to set up a collaborative care relationship with child and adolescent psychiatry? What do you envision as the best way of doing that?
I think that it's sort of a combination of education. It's kind of a partnership where you are working with that pediatric practice or pediatric practices. You go in first by educating the primary care clinicians or specialty pediatricians as well in what they can do, how to screen for mental health problems, how to identify those kids that need tertiary care, some basic kind of information about different sorts of psychotherapy programs, and some basic guidelines on medication management. Then support them in the establishment of programs that enable those processes to work. So they begin to screen for patients. They begin to identify those kids that they can see. As part of the relationship, we would make ourselves available to those practices to see patients that are more complicated than they believe they can take care of. And that's going to be a moving target, right? As they learn more about child and adolescent psychiatry, they're going to get better at it. They're going to be able to take care of more complicated cases. And I think that as these collaborative care programs, whether it's MCPAP or whether it's programs where they have direct connections to pediatric practices and actually hire people going into those practices, they found that these clinicians get better at identifying child and adolescent psychiatric problems and treating them. That if there are cases that get complicated and if there are cases that they feel need tertiary care, that they refer them in and that we are available. We're available kind of on an ongoing basis, right?
So that's your practice. Is it that your tush is in that office, or that you've got a direct phone line, or somebody pushes a button and Dr. Martini materializes? How does that work?
Now, there's a couple of models that actually work pretty well. And there are models, for example, where like at the University of Pittsburgh, at Pittsburgh Children's, they participate in the hiring of mental health professionals that go into those practices. Uh-huh. And they have ongoing contact with them. But those people that work in those practices are local. Uh-huh. And they have access to the expertise that's available through the hospital. And patients travel they're not just referred into tertiary care when they have problems, but they're referred back to primary care when they're stable.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing that I'd like to do, and is actually, there are some hospitals that are doing this. I know Heather Walter, Dave DeMasso at Boston Children's are beginning to get information from these primary care practices on how they're doing. Mm-hmm. So how are they using medications? Are they using them in the way that, the protocol is kind of outlined? Are they struggling to make diagnoses, or are they doing reasonably well? What percentage of patients are they seeing that have mental health problems? I think that's going to be really crucial. Most of what we've done in collaborative care up to this point have been around, clinician satisfaction and patient satisfaction, and those are really good. But I think we also need to look at how well people are doing and what they're doing. And I think that would also be, I think, an important part of what I do. And I think people are already beginning to do that kind of thing.
Where does race come in? One of the things that has really gobsmacked people more than it should have, but it has, obviously, has been that there really is a huge disparity in terms of what's available to our people of color. How does that figure into this?
Well, I think it's an enormous factor. I think I think we know, for example, that African American children are less likely to receive psychotherapy. They're less likely to receive pharmacotherapy. They're less likely to receive substance abuse treatment. That there are a number of reasons for that. I think one of the issues is that there aren't very many child and adolescent psychiatry programs in their neighborhoods. And it's hard for them to get to these programs. There have been a number of recommendations around how to approach this access issue for racial minorities. I think that one of the things that we need to do is we need to make our programs more sensitive to racism and more sensitive to what children and families experience, perhaps even screen for that as we evaluate these kids coming in. The American Academy of Pediatrics came up with some guidelines in 2019 that talked about some specific things that we could do that would improve access. training clinical and office staff around culturally competent care. Also training child and adolescent psychiatry residents to use techniques of simulation and language immersion. I think one of the things that's pretty clear is that if you can't speak English, that's a problem around access, that clearly it's a factor in determining access to care, that we need to advocate for a more diverse workforce. We need to look at who we have in our clinical programs, not just child molested psychiatrists, but other clinicians, administrative staff, and really work at education to try to eliminate implicit bias, to make this a safe and quality place for families to go. I think the other thing is, I really think we need to look at schools and increasing our delivery of mental health care in schools, not only to identify kids that are in need of services, but also to help teachers manage kids that are struggling and are disruptive. We know that we need to keep these kids in the classroom and not suspend them and not take, you know, have them spinning off on a different path. We know, for example, that African-American kids are less likely than white kids to be recognized as needing psychiatric services. And so I think we need to work in schools and work with teachers around these kinds of issues. So I think that the whole notion and the whole idea of racism and healthcare disparities is a huge issue around access to care.
Well, I think I've been a member of ADCAP for, I think, since I became a professor and director of like 30 some odd years ago. And I'm really pleased that the organization has really stepped to the plate to take on some of these challenges. Clearly, I did not expect you in half an hour to solve the problem. So, disclaimer. But I'm hoping that if nothing else comes out of this COVID nightmare, it is the recognition of the importance of mental health, the importance of the fact that we need to work together, not just between us and nurses and social workers and so forth, but us and legislators. You know, I think the advocacy role is extremely important. They need to understand the importance of what it is we do. And maybe they have some traction with the insurance companies to get payment for the services we provide. So I do think it's going to be a work in progress. Anyway, thank you very much for being with us this morning. And I wish you well, and enjoy the rest of your presidency as I will enjoy the rest of my
presidency. Gay, thank you very much. This was a real pleasure. I appreciate you asking me.
Take care. And okay. To our audience, we'll see you for number 20 Screenside Chats.
Thank you all very much for tuning in. This is Gay Carlson for ACAP's Screenside Chats.